Good morning, everybody. Sorry about the size of the room, but we've got the slides from there. We're coming from right back to the making the room smaller. Just before we get into the main purpose of today, I'm waiting to see where my... I'm hardly going to speak, so you're probably wasting the time putting it here, but anyhow. No good, okay. Whether they'll come or not, but then I suppose we can throw our toys out of the cart if they don't come and say, yeah. Okay. All right, let's move on to the Road Accident Fund. Welcome, Veli Mkhlanga, who's the... Still acting? too many acting. Chairperson of the board, and obviously Jake Modito is well known to us, who is the CEO. Billy, can I ask you to introduce your team? But welcome.
Thank you very much, honorable members. The Jack of Modito is making a formal presentation, but before he does this, Mr. Permissi, the entourage, members of the entourage, we have among us here directors, non-executive directors from the Road Accident Fund. We have Mr. Moyo, who's behind me here. I don't know whether maybe it's better for us to see him. Next to me is Dr. Tassou, who is also a non-executive director. Dr. Tassou. A.K. Tassou. A.K. without a full service. And we have also a member of the board, Ms. Manana, who represents the shareholder. He's actually on the other side there. We also have Ms. Moloto Sofile. Yes. Three other directors have apologized. I think last year you might have met Professor Hri. There's also Mr. Mtivi, who's not here, and the chair of audit, Ms. Mutau, unfortunately, could not make it. The officials who form RAF, of course, the CEO is here, who will be making the presentation. With him is the CFO, Andre Fernand. Andre is always with us here, and we have the marketing and communications executive, Ayanda Vilagazu, the new kid on the block. And also with us is the senior manager in the office of the CEO, Lindsay Steve, at the back there. If I could have the honor of introducing the delegation from DOT, we have Maria Clay, with him is Terence Ho, and Dion Perjun. I think that completes our... So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, welcome thanks to the members of the board who have come down. We appreciate that. You know, they've been up full time, and we appreciate the and I'm sure that they're going to be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, I see there are no mics. I hope my voice can be heard at the back there. You can hear me, eh? Honourable Member Farrow.
Yes, sir. Is there any reason why we don't have
this document? Yes. We are getting it, but it arrived. The document arrived. It's an issue our members raise, okay, because we find it more, we find it here. It helps us and therefore helps the input as well, if we are able to read it overnight, so that we can familiarize ourselves. We back the department when they don't give us on time. A bureau, like you said, maybe a little bit more vested.
How
are we supposed to deal with this care? Normally submit the department.
Now, this time around, it's up for system. The disorderness we change.
It's our fault.
Our fault. No. I think what we had done is we just wanted to make sure that we meet with the minister and discuss some of the issues before we hand the presentation. So we changed it after our meeting with the minister. So.
We understand that. Obviously, this is a public process.
Yeah.
And we understand that sometimes it's difficult.
So we know that. Once again, sir, thanks for the opportunity to present our budget and our strategic plan. This is what we're going to be discussing today. I'm hoping everybody can see the slide. We'll touch on how the REF is doing. And by the way, just to forewarn you, I see the slides have arrived. Okay? So that's positive. Just to forewarn you, the reason we have such a big entrance of the board is that we actually have reached the precipice as a road exam fund. And you know, there's some actions and decisions that we're going to be taking, or that we're considering, that are pretty significant, and hopefully they will come along as we make a presentation today. So I think just as a few warning, but I want to just thank members of the board for being present here today. So we'll deal with how we're doing operationally. We'll touch a little bit on financially what our numbers look like and talk about our plan for the new year. I can't take this chair. What I thought I would do is, before we get into a review of where the Rotec and Fund is, maybe have a look back. Take just one or four or five slides, just to take us back onto the rescue plan, and just see where we come from and where we are supposed to be, so that we can see why we're not where we are supposed to be. About 2 years ago, if you recall, this board came to this committee and presented a rescue plan. In that rescue plan, in fact, the board was relatively new. What the board had done when it developed the rescue plan, it made a detailed analysis of the problems that were facing the road accident fund. So, you know, the board came around June 2005. It spent 6 months looking at the challenges that are facing the Rotec fund. It highlighted six of them and then developed a rescue plan around those challenges. We'll go through those challenges again. But the important thing, though, and the important message today is that as a board or as a Rotec fund, we were under no illusion that we could deliver on some of those rescue plan actions on our own. And as it will become clearer to you in a little while, we rely on entities like Parliament, like the government, Department of Transport. We rely on people outside of the RAF itself to help us deliver on some of those rescue plan actions. And today, in fact, there's certain of the areas that have not been achieved that are of concern to us as a board. And perhaps just to take us back to some of the challenges that we had highlighted. This is not new to you. You would have seen it before. We had identified six challenges that were facing us. Around 2 years ago, we said we have an inability to effectively process claims. We have high cost of administration, prevalence of fraud, dissatisfied and disillusioned stakeholders. But what is key, again, was we have an unsustainable economic model. We identified that right at the beginning. We said our model is not sustainable. It's fatally flawed. We had six. In fact, Structural Commission was the seventh commission of inquiry that successive governments had put together to address the problems of the Rotec fund. And despite seven commissions of inquiry, no action had actually been taken. And in fact, all those commissions identified that the model that we operate in is flawed. And then we also indicated that we have poor financial health. But what we had said at that time was because the economic model of the RES is actually written in legislation, we can't change it without your help, without the help of Parliament, without the help of I think this committee, but also without the help of our minister in the department. But also our financial health, we explained where we come from with the way the Rotation Fund was being understood, the way Treasury had looked at funding of the Rotation Fund on a pay-as-you-go basis and that sort of thing, and the problems that it created. Now, those problems are still in place. What the board had done at the time, it changed some of those challenges into strategic objectives. We're not going to go through them in detail because we have seen them. But we also developed them into specific rescue plan action plans. In effect, one of the things that we said we wanted to do is we wanted to eliminate the backlog. Now, unfortunately, we cannot eliminate the backlog if we do not have the funding to pay for the elimination of the backlog. If you recall, and you see when you look at our financial statements, we were sitting with a deficit in excess of 20 billion 2 years ago. That deficit has grown. You'll see when you look at the numbers later that it's now sitting at 27 billion rand. And we haven't received any funding. We'll explain how we get to that level. And in December, we actually had to go slow down the processing of claims as RES. You know, it's very difficult as a CEO to go to your staff members and say, Jesus, you've just been too efficient too quickly. You don't have money to process all the claims that you need to process. And again, there's a difficulty that we have. And I think another thing that is actually amazing is we have some of our stakeholders who are particularly hostile to us. In fact, it's the one set of stakeholders who benefit the most from the RES are the ones who are creating the biggest level of havoc in our lives. So, and I guess those are the legal professionals. If for any reason you're not able to pay, I tell you, we have the sheriff coming to our offices almost on a day-to-day basis. They remove furniture, they remove computers, they remove everything else. And what he's saying is, how do we actually process claims for startups? But secondly,
so are you literally having furniture?
Furniture, computers, physically removed. It's not stressed anymore. In fact, it gets worse because the hostility, they even want to jail me. They now have gone beyond that and they mentioned the CEO by name and they want the CEO put in jail. Something. So it's actually become almost impossible to manage the business. I think in the past, while it was possible, it may have been, previous management may have been able to say, listen, we'll slow down processing of claims because we don't have the cash, and be able to get away with it. We find that it's impossible to run the RES currently with the financial situation that we're in. And all of this will become clearer in a little while. Because we will show you in detail some of the numbers. I think those stakeholders are making our lives unmanageable. But if you go through some of those action items, I mean, we had, even some of those dates that we had set, we wanted to clear the backlog in 3 years. I know when we had discussion with National Treasury, they said, no, clear the backlog in between 5 to 10 years because of the funding issues and that sort of thing. So we wanted to set detailed same target with regards to this. But I guess this is an important slide which you have seen again before. As a board, we recognize that we will not get the model right without involvement of other parties, mainly without changing the legislation that governs the area. In fact, nowhere in the world has changed, successful change been implemented on the RES on similar institutions like us, which did not involve fundamental change in a legislative model. Our engagement on the funding model has so far not really borne fruit, despite the $2 billion that was injected, and we'll talk about it. What we have done is we've gone ahead and implemented some of those organizational transformations. And we'll show you what they are, and I'm going to skip through some of these slides quickly. So what we were hoping is, even as we change operationally our affairs as the REF, and you know, we were bringing a new GEMS management system and all those sort of stuff, that legislative amendments are going to happen in the meantime. Funding of the backlog is going to be agreed also in the meantime, so that we are able, as we transition, we have the money to fund some of the pickup processing that we will be doing. Most of these items we have already implemented. We've done a business diagnostic model. We've built HR capacity. You'll see a lot of new HR executives on here. We've now implemented steps of processes and technology streamlining. We've already gone ahead. We're way down the line with regards to implementing some of those. We have a performance management system. So a lot of these we have already started to roll out. Our communication, we haven't really become that public yet with our communication infrastructure, but we have a new head of communication, and that's one of the things that we're going to be doing in the new year. But obviously it's a big balance that we want him to do. We don't want to communicate some of the activities if we're not able to deliver because we don't have the funds. We'll come back to that. We successfully changed to SAP. It took us 5 months to implement and roll out SAP in the Rotterdam fund. The bulk of the core modules are in place. We actually went live in November. November, December last year. So, yes, SAP is a German enterprise resource planning solution. What it does is it brings a lot of different systems together. It brings accounting, you know, materials management, procurement, all sorts of systems in a business together. It's actually one of the more well-known engine to run processes in organizations. So one of the things that we did is we discovered the world when we wanted to implement one of these new systems. And I mean, we looked at other solutions, Oracle and all this sort of stuff, and SAP came up top. It's used by a lot of organizations, private sector organizations in the country. So we now have implemented private sector type processes within the fund. We've begun to roll out a new GEMS management system. It's called Senior. The name is at the bottom there. Once again, what we've done when we looked at the GEMS management system is we looked at entities similar to us throughout the world. And our sister companies, for instance, in Australia and New Zealand are using Senior, and even in the UK and that sort of thing. So in terms of sharing information and that, we felt that it was the best solution. And we've begun to roll this out. Now, so we are making significant changes within the organization. Unfortunately, the numbers are beginning to become a constraint. As we become more efficient, as we will see, as we become more efficient, the funding constraint becomes a serious issue. Okay? And what I've also done is I've looked back and said, when this board came out, what are some of the objectives that the minister had set for us? The minister has said to us, you must stabilize, achieve a turnaround of the fund that achieves stability, efficiency, and sustainability. The REF is stable, but we are nowhere near sustainable. Now, our efficiency, we become a lot more efficient, as you have seen, in terms of the way we process our claims. But if we now have to slow down the processing of claims, that is extremely frustrating. We can never be as efficient as we can be. The second objective was to build capacity. And that we're doing. As we are rolling out SAP and that sort of thing, we've been retraining a lot of our staff within the REF for new technologies and that sort of thing. One area of concern is we are actually are not delivering what we should do and what we can do. You know, we have the ability to process about close to R1 billion worth of claims per month, but we only receive around 600-700 million worth of fuel levy income. And you can understand the frustrations that we have to deal with on a regular basis. And that's why it's very difficult to really start celebrating our successes with some of our stakeholders.
So you have the ability to
process in excess of R1 billion worth of claims per month. Our fuel levy income that you get per month is between 600-700 million. And what that means is in fact this year, as you'll see in the numbers, we had to dig deep into our cash resources. And by November we had no more excess cash left, and you'll see in the slide. And which typically meant that we had to go slow down the processing of claims, and that's the difficulty that we had. But some of the numbers quickly, because these numbers will give you an idea of how we performed. And this is performance for this current financial year. We did share with you as a committee our performance for the previous financial year. In October when we presented our financial results. So for the current financial year, 2008, the three colors, the blue is actual up to December. And then the red is forecast, where we forecast to be by the end of the year, and the budget will always be in blue. So we compare to what we contained in our budget in the previous year. You'll see that our revenues are only coming back to the levels that we had in 2006. So that in itself is a constraint. But remembering again though, in 2006, we had a special allocation of $2.5 billion. That was a transfer payment that we received to clear some debt out. And in fact, that money was spent even before it was received. Because $1 billion was owed to the receiver, another $1 billion was people that the REF said could not pay, and they were structured payments. And so $2 billion of it was already gone, so $2.2 billion. And the remaining amount was just to fund our new systems and processes. So our revenues are just getting back to where we were in 2006. The bulk of it, again, is coming from fuel levy income. Again, our legislation constrains us to just getting our funding only from fuel levy income. So we can't go develop new products and that sort of thing. We can't go sell pet packages or any other thing, because that's what our legislation constrains us to do. So that makes up the bulk of the $8 billion. These figures provided by South African Petroleum Industry Association indicate that volumes of diesel and petrol sold rose 7%. Obviously, this is just on a calendar to calendar basis. But we also received 5 cents in the previous year in RAF fuel levy. Now, again, if you recall in our rescue plan, one of the things that we said we wanted as a board was the 5 cents is simply not enough. Not enough to clear the backlog. Not when you have a backlog in excess of 20 billion. And it's actually just barely enough just to process current year claims. Now, if you look at the fuel levy, that the REF gets when you compare it to what people pay in the pump, it's really less than 5%. And in fact, other margins account for a much, much bigger slice of the levy that is made on fuel. Now, the critical thing to understand though is I know when the Minister of Finance was making his announcement, we were talking about the fuel levy being a tax burden on South Africans. We'd like to look at the business of the REF a little differently, and we will deal with it later on. But I have just to touch on it a little bit now. Is that, you know, if you step back and say, what is it that the REF is doing? What is the business that the REF is undertaking? Our business is very different from, from a social good that would probably need to be funded from taxes. By that I mean this, is that we actually are providing a specific service. And that service is simply this, it's just a peace of mind. So all we're saying is, all users of Sarafkin Road have a peace of mind that in the event that something happens as they use our road, as they walk out of the homes and they get onto the road, in the unfortunate event that something happens, that they will be covered. It just happens to be a compulsory cover, so we are a monopoly. I think that's the critical thing. Now, Sarat can pay for the cover. It just happens to be a general cover in the sense that the benefits you get are unlimited, but it is covered nonetheless, and somebody pays for it. Now, technically, what should be happening is we should be having a regulator who goes and determines the price for that unlimited cover. Okay? No different from Telkom going and determining the right price for telecommunication service that is being provided, or Eskom, where a regulator goes or a NESA goes and determines the right price that of electricity that should be covered. Not as a tax. The simple is a different regulator that goes out and says, that's the product that you're offering, that's the service you're offering, and yes, if it's unlimited, and this is the cost, how much should the fee be? It shouldn't just be an allocation of revenues by the state. And again, that's one of the flaws in the model that we have, that the institutional arrangements are not the right arrangements as it relates to this industry. And as such, again, we just looked at a tech where we're competing with, building of stadiums and all those sort of stuff. And I think that really is a misunderstanding of what our business is. But we'll come back to that in a little while. If you look at the numbers for this year, diesel rebate is continuing to grow, but that's growing in line with still levy income. Now, we're projecting it to be just under 700 million. Our investment income dropped substantially this year, and we're projecting it to drop, mainly because we actually do not have, we've depleted our cash resources. Now, if you look at entities similar to us, even in South Africa, but also throughout the world, they are building a base. They build an investment base that covers the liability. And in fact, when you look at the balance sheet, you will always find that they have assets under investment that are supposed to exceed the liabilities, no different from a pension fund. And that's why our act requires the REF to be monitored by the Financial Services Board. It's precisely because you need to have a capital adequacy ratios that are determined on that basis. Now, with us, our investments are really erratic because they're based on the income that you get, not based on any proper investment philosophy and anything like that. Our colleagues like the Workman Compensation, they build investments, even if those investments are managed by the TIC. We don't even have enough cash to start building our investments. So investment income is really erratic and you really cannot learn it. What helped us this year is that interest rates were a little high while they increased over the year. That's the only reason why it hasn't dropped as much as we had budgeted for it to drop to. Now, this is where, in terms of expenses, this is where the strategy of the board is highlighted. We have continued to say that we will, to the best of the resources we have, deliver on the service that we're supposed to provide. So you'll see that our total expenses, we are projecting them to reach 13.7 billion by the end of the financial year. And if you recall, fuel levy income in the figure slide was less than 8 billion. So we're getting total income of 8 billion, and we are going ahead and we say we're going to spend close to 13 billion by the end of the financial year. So the money has to come somewhere. And that money you will see it reflected in a substantial reduction in cash holdings that we had in our balances. And that slide will cover there. So we have chosen up to today to go and spend the money on trying to clear the backlog as much as we can rather than rebuilding our balances. And I think it's reflected in this number. So the bulk of the increase in the expenses comes from claims expenditure. Obviously, included in the 13 billion that we're forecasting for the end of the year will be provision for outstanding liability, which will come to in a little while. But this one is actually important to note. In 9 months, we have spent as an RES more money than we have spent for the whole of the previous financial year. So we have spent close to 6.4 billion rand. 6.4 billion rand was physically spent processing claims by the end of the by the 9 months to December, which is more than what we have spent for the whole of last year. And that's because we're getting more and more efficient. Even though we haven't quite rolled out our new claims management systems, which, to be honest, once we roll them out, the efficiency is going to really shoot through the sky. It's going to grow exponentially. This one is just tweaking and doing small changes within the operation. We spend more money than we spent last year. Now, unfortunately, in the RES, that's not always good news. Because if you don't have the money in the bank, you start running into problems. We have contained, staff costs are increasing, I guess, in line with where the market has been. You'll see we haven't increased our staff complement. The slide will come in a little while. It's in line with where we are budgeting to be. Our admin costs were rising mainly because we busy rolling out certain new systems and processes and that sort of thing. We're projecting to be a little lower, well, much lower than where we ought to have been by the end of the financial year. It's mainly the timing of the rollout of the claims system. So we will spend a lot of the money relating to seniors, this new claims management system in the new year. But we were always expecting our admin costs to rise as we build new systems, as we invest in systems. Now, the approach that we now have to follow, and we've begun to follow since the beginning of the financial, since the beginning of November, is to relook at the mix of our processing of claims. And again, it's a little fair, in the sense that, because of the cash shortage, we have to now say we will go process small little claims, which are mainly supply claims, which are mainly hospital groups, as opposed to the real people who need the money. And again, there's the sadness that we have. So by December, we had processed about 184,000 claims. We will still make, we're forecasting to still make the same level of claims that we had processed in the previous financial year, 260,000 claims. It's higher than budget, where we are budgeting today. But we could have actually done better than this if it wasn't for the cash constraint. If you look at the balance of the makeup of the claims that we had at the end of December, our spending claims, we're sitting with 347,000 claims. The bulk of them, 100,000 of them are supply claims. And we have no choice but to just focus on those supply claims because value wise they're smaller, although volume wise they're higher. Slide 29 will reflect that we actually are experiencing an increase in reported claims this financial year. The whole of last year we received 170,000. This year it's been going through the sky. Could be a combination of people anticipating the Amendment Act and all those sort of things. But again, it's also growth in the economy, with foreigners coming into the country and economic activity improving. So we anticipate that outstanding claims by the end of the financial year, we will try and keep it below 334,000. If you recall, when we began, we were sitting with 500,000 outstanding claims. we believe we could have done better than this. We actually could have really started eating into the backlog, but had it not been for cash constraints. Now, if you look at some of the makeup of the payments that we make in plan, again, about $2 billion is going to go to the legal profession. And by the way, that $2 billion excludes the contingency fee that they charge to the client. And as I indicated when we last presented to this committee, that for all intents and purposes, the entire $8 billion goes through the bank accounts of that client. Because 99% of the claims are made through that claim. So, in reality, even the $6 billion that we pay, at the moment we have no knowledge of how or when it reaches the claimant, because all of it gets channeled through the bank accounts of that claimant. And then they keep whatever they like to keep for contingency and stuff like that. So at the moment we still have no knowledge of, well, we have no control of how much money eventually gets to the claimant. We have started a process of direct payment system, which has received a lot of resistance from, I guess, legal professors. But we are implementing it. We started looking at it for the major hospital groups, including sister organizations like the Department of Health and provincial hospitals and that sort of thing. So we feel that it's better that they get the bulk of the cash directly and as soon as possible, as opposed to through the middleman. So we believe we can speed up the processes. But again, direct payment system also helps us in the sense that we can electronically link with some of the hospital groups. And in future, if we roll out the new claim system and spread, you know, that we can actually pay them as soon as we can. But we're still waiting, in my mind, you know, $2 to $3 billion if we include contingencies that could be available to pay claims. And again, for as long as the Amendment Act is not in place, by the end of this financial year, we would have paid $3.9 billion, so close to $4 billion in general damages. $4 billion in general damages. And had we started rolling out some of those limitations that are envisaged in the Amendment Act that I know this committee worked hard to put in place, like limiting, you know, the claim to serious injury, that $4 billion could become available to pay other claims. And again, this slide reflects a sad story, because what it's saying is that the people for which the RES was formed, or the service that the RES should be performing, which is really true, we should be reintegrating those excellent victims back into society from a health perspective. So if somebody has got broken bones and stuff like that, we're supposed to go fix the bones. And if you look at that slide, we are only spending $500 million. $500 million out of the total $6 billion that we pay. And that $6 billion, remember, excludes the payments that we make to our tenants. In reality, we're only spending $500 million out of $8 billion. $8 billion, because $2 billion of that $6 billion goes to our tenants. We actually only spending $500 million just to fix somebody's bones, to reintegrate people back into society from a health perspective. Because the second objective should be to reintegrate the ex-and victims back into society from an economic perspective, which means that if somebody has lost their job and they're not able to have a job, we should go replace their income, or if their family has lost a breadwinner, which we're supposed to be replacing all of them, we're spending $2 billion out of the $8 billion. So that $4 billion that we're spending in general damages really is wasted. And it could be available for other purposes. But because we're processing, we continue to have marginal improvements in efficiency gains. You'll see our cost to compensation ratio has been coming down in the last 2 to 3 years. the total at the bottom there, you'll see it's gone down from 49% to 48, 44, and for the period up to December, you are sitting at 40%. So we are accelerating the processing of claims. But once again, that cost to compensation ratio, I think what it's trying to reflect is how much we're spending, the administration costs that we engage in paying a claim. We still believe it's high, and if we got the model right, we could actually reduce it much, much bigger than this. All we need to do, for instance, is to reduce this, the change from a fall-based system of compensation to a no-fall system of compensation. Then you're getting rid of a lot of the middlemen, and trust me, the cost of paying a claim would reduce substantially. 40% is still relatively high. And the most we can do at the RES is right at the margin, because the model, unfortunately, is encoded in legislation and it can't change. Okay, and once again, some of the efficiency gains are being hampered by shortages of cash. So our staff members have actually been finalizing a lot more claims, but and this is without the new claims management system. When it comes out, they'll be able to process much, much faster. But then we'll then start running into cash flow problems. Our staff complement has not increased. It's still sitting at 1,800. But unfortunately, our filling claims liability is projected to grow. And just to remind us where this comes from, it actually annually go and do evaluation of this liability. They look at the claims that we have in our system. They look at accidents that have occurred that have not been reported to us, because in terms of our law, claimants have got anything between 3 to as much as 21 years for the age of majority to report the claim. So they take that into account, accident that happens but not reported. And they're projecting this to increase to 27 billion. And it's a function of a number of things. The economy keeps growing, so there's increasing economic activity. We haven't faced cap because the Amendment Act is not in place yet. And we have a lot more foreigners coming into the country. So that's one of the causes of that increase. Now, this is our cash balances that we're sitting at now. And this is where we really have become pretty worried as a board of the RES. You'll recall 2004 is the year when RES physically ran out of cash. And then it started saying to claimants, we will pay you in installments. Now, with the way we were processing our claims, we've now get into that situation where we actually are also running out of cash because we're becoming more efficient. Because elements of our rescue plan have not been funded. Because what we had wanted was our rescue plan to be funded. And up to now, we haven't been successful in getting, government support in terms of funding some of those elements of our rescue plan. And this is where what I'm saying when you say we're now right back at the precipice that we were in 2004. Now, the people who are pushing us over the precipice are those the legal profession that I mentioned. And, you know, it's leaving us with very little choice but to consider certain of the options. In a sense, they really are making our life ungovernable. It's not fun running the area when, especially when everybody knows what the solution is, but we are actually not implementing. You know, none of these things are new. It's not something that we haven't spoken about at the beginning, 2 years ago, when we looked at the rescue plan. It's just that I think not all role players have come to the party. But unfortunately, the legal profession are pushing us over the precipice because they are not understanding. They are touching our assets, they are taking us to court, and someone says increase. We've got the judiciary complaining that we blocked their, we denied our applicants access to justice because we blocked the court roll. But we can't remove all of those cases from the court roll because we don't have the funding to go pay all of them. So where we are as a board is we are now considering, in fact, one of the mechanisms that are that our act allows us to that our act allows us to invoke, which is section 21 of the RESA. I think previous leadership had chosen to do things that really just got things worse, like structured payment, paying payments in installments and all those sort of stuff. Just so that everyone understands what section 21 of our act says, is that section that practically and maybe to use legalese, but that section of the act is taking away the constitutional rights of the wrongdoer or of the claimant to sue the wrongdoer. What it's saying is, if somebody has caused an accident to you, if somebody has caused you harm, it's through the use of a motor vehicle, you cannot go claim from him any amount of money unless the RES says that it's unable to pay. So it's got that proviso. It says, in fact, you're only suspending your constitutional right for as long as the RES can pay your claim. But if RES cannot pay the claim, it says you can go ahead and sue one another. And if you go back to historically to, you know, the reasons why entities like us were created, in fact, not just here, worldwide, was precisely because people used to see one another. Before the 40s, before the, you know, some of our early legislation came in, people used to just use common law. If somebody caused you harm in an accident, you used to go sue them and recover your damages from them, the same damages that we paid. I think one of the problems that we experienced in those days was that two things. One, the wrongdoer often, especially if it was somebody who did not have means, would actually get financially ruined because they would get sequestrated. Okay? And to rehabilitate yourself from being declared insolvent takes a lot of doing. It takes a couple of years and you have to go through lots of processes to become a rehabilitated insolvent. So it created social chaos, and by the way, that, you know, after the World Wars and everybody, there were the Model T's now, and vehicles were no longer the preserve of the rich. Everybody who could afford a Model T used to get some of those vehicles. So it did create a cost to society. But the second thing was that the accident victim did not always get compensation. So if somebody used to have a job and used to earn income, and they suddenly got injured and they became paralyzed and they lose their job, the problem was, if the person who caused them harm did not have sufficient income or did not have sufficient assets to satisfy your claim was not satisfied. But still, people used to see one another. And that's why a fourth insurance, a fourth cover was created in the form of the RES. Where we made a mistake was when we set this up as a monopoly, we forgot to put all the institutional arrangements to make it a viable business. So, I think as a board, we're not saying we have to implement it. What we're saying is, we don't have the cash. We have a number of factors. We have a model where, and you'll see after we look at the budget, a model where fuel levy income is being determined without a real economic model. I think from where we sit as the RES, we actually do not participate in the determining of the fuel levy income. We don't make any presentation to anybody. You know, a telecom would go and make a presentation to any charter annually or any of the telecommunication operators and say, this is my business. And this is, you know, what the tariff should be like. And that's how the tariffs are set. Our tariff is set without the RES involvement. And in fact, from where we sit, it just looks to us like it's just sucked out of the thumb, because there is no economic model that is used to determine. And there is no way of knowing whether it's sufficient or not. And therein lies the problem. And in fact, this is where we're going to come to now, because then the key question is, that 5 cents should let it increase, that the Minister of Finance announced, will it help? You know, I've just said that in November we are running out of cash, will that 5 cents help? What we've done is, in a strategic plan, we had that we submitted to the Department of Transport in October, we actually modeled a number of scenarios, and the 5 cents per liter increase was not our preferred scenario. In fact, our preferred scenario required of us to have a cash injection plus at least 10 cents. But if you recall, our rescue plan wanted increases only for a few years. You know, that way in the regions of the 40 cents and that sort of thing, only for a few years, just to fund the backlog, until the backlog was satisfied. And by the way, we're not the only entity in the world that has been sitting with a backlog. We look at our sister entities, like the New Zealand entity. They have a tariff that is determined using a model. And what that model does is they charge, say, a special levy to cover the backlog, and a normal levy to cover ongoing costs. And in there, if you look at the financial statement, they say they will become solvent in 2014. But somebody will eventually pay for this backlog. But these are some of the assumptions that underlie our strategic plan. Obviously, we had to make macroeconomic assumptions on steel levy income. We just put them there, I think, just for information. The assumptions that we made in relation to claims and claims reporting, because they are drawn from growth in the economy and growth in GDP and that sort of thing. One thing that we had to take out of the strategic plan and our budget for next year is that the block right at the bottom, that said savings from Amendment Act. I think the committee is aware of the delays that has occurred in this Amendment Act, and there was a constitutional court hearing about a week or so ago, and I'm sure Marius will explain where it is now. But every year we've been projecting that Amendment Act will come in at the 1st of April, and I think because of the constitutional challenges and stuff, we had to take the Amendment Act out, any savings from the Amendment Act. Again, we actually also have to take out of the model. Our model can handle no fall because we had actuaries operate our model, design our model in a way that it can operate even in a no fall environment. But again, all these assumptions relating to no fall, we had to take them out of our planning horizon, out of our 3-year planning horizon. And then there are some of those operational assumptions. Now, the critical thing is, if you look at our cash flow, let's start with our income statement on page 47. You will see that what happens to our steel levy income, this year it will be under 7.8 billion at the top there. We're projecting it to grow to 9 billion. It will be driven by not only the 5 cents, but also the volume increase because of economic activity and that sort of thing. But unfortunately, if you go down to claims page, just below expenditure, you'll see that we will not show any improvement in the claims that we're going to process in the new year. And remember that the only reason we were able to process 8 billion worth of claims this year, when we received 7 billion in steel levy income, is because we had cash balances that we utilized. Now we have nothing. So again, we're going to have to say there will not be efficiency improvement. You know, sometimes it's sad because it's almost like saying to staff, go work for 6 months in the year and then go home for the rest of the time. So the only difficulty is you get the income only 10 months. So, you know, you don't know whether to say, oh, we've used up 600 million, so the rest of the month just sit and do nothing, because you used up all the cash that you have. So in the budget for the next year, again, we are constrained by the cash. So we're not going to process more links than that I'll use to show the numbers I'm talking about. You'll see that we're not going to show any growth in the processing of links, in all the damages that is looking at. Now, if you look at the balance sheet, you will see that 1 billion rand of cash, normally for risk management, you're supposed to carry as a liquidity buffer at least 2 months worth of claims as cash, as a liquidity buffer. This year we're going to take it all the way down to less than 1.5 months. And 5 cents per liter increase, we run out of cash. We literally run out of cash before the end of the financial year. Again, it says that it's not sufficient. But what is also key though is we are just postponing the problem, because this problem will continue to grow, and that liability, at the time that we do deal with it, it may in fact become 50 billion. At the moment we're still talking about a 20 billion problem. So as long as we don't do certain things, so as long as we don't go and implement a change in the economic model, introduce no cost as an example, start putting caps with Amendment Act and that sort of thing, and then as long as we don't establish an appropriate economic model to determine the funding of the fuel levy, and we don't fund the backlog, at the time that we address the problem, it's going to be expensive. It's going to be 50 billion in terms of the model that we have. And again, all we're saying is our future generations will pay for this. And the bottom line though is it's all well and good to think that we can avoid the problem. Trust me, a future generation will pay for it, unless we invoke Section 21 and we say to everybody, stop seeing one another. We now see in our hands of this. And again, therein lies the problem, because we're saying don't wait till the problem becomes so big that it costs the economy too much money. Because I think the RES is still one area. I mean, we've had so many successes, as a new government. This is one area where it's still, I think, a little cancer that unfortunately is growing. Okay? And in fact, you'll see that you're not even generating cash flow from operating activities, which means that all these improvements that we're making in systems and processes, we're not even able to fund. Look at our cash flow. I guess the conclusion in terms of our budget for next year and the fast and fuel levy increase is that the country urgently needs a model that will be used to determine an appropriate fuel levy. And it's more than just a model. It's also an institutional framework. We cannot have the fuel levy determined without consideration of the area, the economics in the area, or us even being present. I don't recall ever being called to a meeting where you're saying we're going to work out the fuel levy. RES come and tell us what it should be. And there is no model. And fortunately, we do have actuarial models that can determine this, that tells you what our revenue requirement is. And it's no different from a model that a regulator like an ICASA or NESA would use for, the ESCOMs and the TELCOMs of the world. And I think the second conclusion is, for as long as we delay in funding our turnaround strategy, this board will fail, and in fact we will fail. The problem though is the country will pay more in the future. So for as long as we don't want to fund the backlog, and remember we are making changes in the RES to enable us to process the backlog and pay quicker. So as long as we don't go and fund it, we will, the future, I think South Africa will still pay in the future, because this is not going away. But what is key though is this Section 21. We really are going to be careful before we invoke Section 21, and we want to engage more carefully. At the moment all we're doing is investigating it, because there are all sorts of practical issues, because we're still getting 600-700 million per month. When you say, how do you deal with, how do you actually practically implement it? you say to certain claimants, oh no, we paid up to 700 million. Those people who are likely to be part of the 700 million have been paid, and then the balance we're saying, sorry, section 21, we are unable to pay you. You know, is there all sorts of practical issues? Can you, you know, would you be discriminating certain claimants as opposed to others? So how do you operate it? First in, first out, because we still have a backlog of claims. What it will help us, though, is that our business will not be unmanageable, in the sense that we will not continue to have summonses and writs and the sheriff at our office daily, because that's exactly what we're living with now. But the downside of it is that the South African public, without real preparation, will suddenly find that they have obligations you know, upon themselves that they hadn't budgeted for, when people start seeing them directly. So that's, I think that's the 5 cents per liter and the frustrations that we as a board are experiencing actually overshadow some of those strategic thrusts that we as a board had been looking at. Because one of the things that we had done in a strategic plan, and you'll see we didn't cover them in detail in this slide, is that we wanted to obviously look at four key areas in the new year. One of them, cost reduction, cost management, which we, you know, we can do, but if you look at the amount of money that we spend compared to the rest of the admin costs, our admin costs are less than half a billion, and if you look at the cost of administering the system, with our tennis and those sort of things, in excess of 2 billion, you'll see that whatever savings we make will be just a scratch on the surface. We have to change the model. But we still want to pursue legislative influence. We want to appeal to families like yourself for support in ensuring that we have a system that's affordable to South Africans. But what's critical is we have to recapitalize the business. I mean, legislation does indicate a situation where the FSD reports on us, and we work on the adequacy solvency ratios that they set for us. At the moment, the report they sent to Parliament, you know, every time I read it, I really don't understand it, because what they're saying is they can't actually report on the area. Technically, they should be saying the area must close its doors, because it doesn't meet the solvency requirements. But we understand that we can't, we is still continuing. So they write a wishy-washy report to Parliament annually. Fortunately, the law does require of them to write a report on us. But I think we need to get to a situation where we recapitalize the business. But we also say that, you know, we are repository of information relating to accidents, and we can actually inform a little bit more on some of the accident prevention activities that are undertaken elsewhere, that in fact we should be mining our data and helping in being proactive in preventing accidents. But what we've done is we've actually said that we need to just re-examine our business, reset our vision and mission to align ourselves with the real business that we are. You remember our vision used to be that we'll be world-class administrators. In reality, we provide cover. And you'll see our revised vision is that we want to be sustainable, but we do recognize that we do provide peace of mind cover for personal injury through the use of motor vehicles in South Africa. And we just want to make sure that the cover is appropriate. It must be affordable to us, and we'll look at rehabilitation and compensation. We'll do it in a timely and fair manner, and we want to stop the claims before they come in, and that's why we want to get involved in at least an element of road safe use of our road. We've got some new values which I'm not going to go through, in detail. And that, Mr. Chairman, is a completed version of my presentation to the committee.
Okay, thank you very, very much for that. Sober, quite concerned, quite alarmed, but very confidently as was presented. So thank you very much.
Yes.
Okay, let's have input from members, questions, input from what I recognize too. I see another thing, I see Lennox, I see Matt, I mean, your teacher and the other. Saying that the FSCB is the same, but that's okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the support from the people who are coming to the board. And I think that our concern is the same as this. But there's a couple of things I would just like to do a clarification on. The one related to the computer system, because if you ask, if I talk to us about Europe, we indicated that there were really some changes in respect of the administration costs relating to the implementation of that computerized system or electronic system from the manual processing, which was obviously it was antiquated and the new actually written system went around the office from Europe. So I would just like to actually ask that, because if the costs are rising in respect of the computer costs and the electronic system, I would have thought we would have moved down. Then what is the impact of you now about looking at that and for all intents and purposes also the SARS component, which has actually risen slightly in fact in 2005? Because, you know, this is a worrying concern, and I think you noticed that this was never quite a lot with you before, that you would like to see this fund move towards an administrational function as opposed to a legislative function, which is consistently looking at legal costs of a very high nature, 10 for ourselves for the RX and maybe 19% for the fund. Now, if that is the case, I was just wanting to know what in fact is taking place in restructuring. Let's talk about that. I don't like using the word retrenchment because effectively this particular organization, we all know, has the biggest legal fraternity outside the Department of Justice, and they are not. So I'd like to just get that sort of clarity about the moving to the electronic system and the actual cost, which I would have thought would have come down. The second thing, Chair, if I can continue, relates to the matter about the... the section 21. Do you have a copy of the chair that you can see? Is that something that you're looking at? I think it's true, you can have a good idea. And leading to that, the other thing relates now to the Amendment Act, which is now nearly 3 years down the line. I assume I used to report to you about the status quo that we could still have hearing on my question. But needless to say, at the same time last year, I also raised the issue or one of our meetings as to whether we as legislators should not repeal the Amendment Act, bring the Act back. Let the Constitutional Court case go through on that part of the amendment that is not affected or is implicated by virtue of that court case, and let's go and reconsider another new amendment act, which effectively can then put into place the tax and the issue of the foreign tax.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way I look at this thing here, actually, is that, you know, the money that's coming on this passing levy is really a very good burden on merchants in terms of other increases, let's say, that were affected as of last night, we are not going to get more fuel. So in fact, your projections might be less, because people are actually now being told not to use their cars, and public transport initiatives that are coming into place to take them out of their cars. So in effect, you might end up with less money than the actual one single claim that still sits with us, the $1.6 billion from the First Nation. It's like going into a pit, which doesn't even compensate each other, the cost of one single trip.
I don't think our community society is founded for that country. I think we
A lot of computer systems, when you implement them, you invest the money up front and then you get the benefit in the new year. So I think what happened this year in my presentation, what I said is we now have rolled out 30 systems. So the new systems and processes, unfortunately, you still buy the software and then you implement the rollout and that sort of thing. We should expect to see some of the benefits in the new year. And I think we're going to find the same thing with claim. The claim system is a little more intricate. So it's going to, as we roll it out in the rollout will still continue in the new year. We will still be spending money up front as we roll out and implement. And just to define what the processes involved are, is that, you know, we actually come up with something called the blueprint of how the operation should work. And in that blueprint, and I think where you're going to see the biggest impact is when we roll out claims as opposed to SET. Because what we're doing with SET is we were dealing with some of the, let's just call them support businesses, like HR, accounting, and that sort of thing. So we didn't quite have as many I think loss of staff as one would expect. And in fact, what we've done is we've just retrained a lot of our staff members. They are current new skill, which is subscale. But it was essential that we have an ERP solution to underpin the rest of our solutions, because we need to be able to get to a situation where when we link up with the hospital group, or when we really fully roll out FET and claims management system, and a client wants to know what the status of that claim is, whether on the internet or wherever the place is, they need to be able to see all the way right to payment. And so that's one of the reasons why we needed to actually implement an ERP solution. I think our business diagnostic model did indicate right at the beginning that when we do reorganize our claims environment, we can actually run it with around 700 staff members. Now, because we are now in the process of rolling this out, it will be a little bit more defined. I guess what we're saying is the attorneys and those sort of people who are involved in our business, I think the operations will change. For as long as we have a four-based system, there may be a small specialist area where they may get involved, but there won't be a jack of all trades. At the moment, they are specialists in everything. They are actuaries, they are financial gurus, they are medical gurus, they are everything. They are even claims administrators, they are call center administrators. So the job of a claim handler will change, certainly, and the requirements and the qualification will be completely different. So that we will start to see in the new year. So that's the first question relating to restructuring, and I think the number of attorneys. That's what I need to also add in with regards to this one, especially the reduction of legal costs. We've also tried to follow what other people have done in the same state elsewhere in the world. For instance, Australians went ahead and started off their own internal law firm. And if you can imagine the amount of money we spend on our panel attorneys, we spend just under $1 billion. It's actually about $700 million. Even if we went ahead and employed 1,000 staff members in a law firm, the legal bill will never come anywhere close to, the salary bill will never come anywhere close to the billion rand. But in fact, our salary bill is actually only 400 million for 2,000 staff members. So that's the sort of trade-off that some of the things that we are actually looking at implementing in the meantime to reduce our legal costs. Now the second 21, your second question, second 21, you want us to actually physically see it.
Very busy walking around with that in your
This computer has got everything. This is but what I'm going to try and do is highlight, in fact I should have highlighted some of the ways. This is physically what it says, and that's why it's in code. It says, when a third party is entitled under section 17, and by the way, you must just bear with us because it's legalese, it takes a long time to get to what it's trying to say. So when somebody is entitled under this under section 17 to claim from the fund, and then it says, or an agent, etc., any compensation in respect of any loss or damage resulting from any bodily injury or death of a person, and it says caused by the driving of motor vehicle. Again, this is all legalese. In reality, it's only saying if somebody is entitled to claim, that person may not claim. This is where it suspends the person's ability to claim. So you may not claim from the owner or from the person who drove the vehicle, so from the wrongdoer. So if that third party is entitled to claim, it says you cannot claim from the owner of the vehicle or the wrongdoer. And then it also talks about if the person was waiting for a job, well, was in an employee. This is the key. It says unless the fund or such agent is unable to pay. So it starts off by prohibiting. It says you prohibited from claiming, from suing the wrongdoer, unless you're saying you cannot claim. And I have to also say that this section is currently being used in certain areas where our damages are limited. For instance, where you have passenger claims and you have the 25,000 limit. I know the Amendment Act is changing it. Where you have the 25,000 limit, this section is being used because the interpretation, I think the current interpretation is that the arrears being unable to pay is just, the limit means it can pay. And that's been the legal interpretation. So it's currently being used under the circumstances. But
that's funny because we'll just like to flex you this some of the debate and the next constitutional challenge, one of the next that will come to the amendment bill. Because we were revoking credibility and some inability to be both
So this one is a legislative because you're putting cap. So there will be discussions around this to say when we have the amendment and we have 160,000 cap, can somebody sue in excess of the 160? And that's the key question. Now, your third question in terms of the amendment and bringing it back here, I'll get person from the Department of Transport to come back to us. Yeah. But only to just add, before I let Stuart's question, so in terms of the Swiss National, he's now revised his bill, it's now 2.2 billion. Ridiculous. I mean, really. He said he had forgotten to estimate certain of his damages and all those sort of stuff. It's no longer 1.6, 1.7 billion. He's now formally revised it with us, and he wants to claim 2.2 billion. And that means that is ridiculous. But perhaps let me deal with the rest of the questions before you deal with the amendment legislation question. The regulations, I think you will deal with them. But in terms of the business model, we do have a new vision that I tried to show at the top there. But I think with us running into a cash flow problem, I didn't go through the details of some of the strategic stuff that we wanted to follow under those four headings. And again, I've covered a little bit your questions about how do we reduce the involvement of lawyers in the fund. We are going to look at an internal law firm and the education of the community. We have a communication plan, and we have appointed Ayanda, who's sitting across the room there. And again, what we're doing is we're doing a balancing act. with the communication. Because what he's saying though is we need to do two things. In the first instance, we want to make sure that operationally we are ready to handle those claims, the direct claims, when the claimants do come to us. And by the way, the form has been simplified. It, at the time that I think the minister published the regulation, it will incorporate the new revised form. And one of the simplified forms, one of the forms actually just requires somebody to just complete basic information and bring it to us, and we will proactively go and find the information for the claimants. So those forms have been changed. Now, the new vision and mission, I don't know whether you'd like for me to show them. You have seen them. So they are also in the slide. Okay. And I think Andre will just set you, perhaps I just need to add that we've already rolling out some of these activities. For instance, we started with the provincial hospitals and we're going to private hospitals. They now have allowed us access to, they've allowed us, they've given us desks in the hospital. And that way is one way of obviously making sure that the claims get processed quicker, that we know that they are valid claims. Because if somebody gets work in the hospital, because that's one of our vision, is if somebody gets work in the hospital and a file is open, what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to register a claim right there and then, rather than wait for 3 years, 10 years, and people start lying and coming to teach us accidents and stuff like that. But it serves two purposes. We can then process the claim quicker, because we've got the merit of the case, we know what happened and stuff like that. You know, and the provincial hospitals get the money quicker, and then we take out a lot of the middlemen. So that's one of the things that we do. So we do have a vision and mission. I don't know if you see the slides, I don't know if you want me to show it. And perhaps, Leonard's question, the funding model, we have that model. And in fact, all these, our strategic plans are driven from an externally developed model. Yeah.
What is the response? You've given us a sense of what the funding model is. What kind of response?
What kind of response? In fact, we shared this, I think, last week with the minister. And he asked us to actually come up and maybe do a presentation on that funding model. Because all it is a revenue requirement model. He said, this is the benefit we give, and that's what is required to fund this model. And I think DOT, but again I'll ask DOT to assure it. We ask them to obviously help us sell the model to National Treasury, because they are the ones who are sending this bill. You know, it's not even our minister who's determining the field lady. You know, and so we have asked DOT's assistance and our minister's assistance in making sure that it's put in place. And but I'll ask DOT to respond to that. And I think your point about the continuing society not being ready for it. I think as a board, we want, that will only be implemented as a last resort. In fact, at the moment, all we've been doing is we've been trying to get opinions on how do you practically do this. However, what we would like to do though is engage, you know, with National Treasury, with our minister and everything else to say, you know, society is probably not ready for this. I mean, we already have bad news with ESCOM and everything else. And if there's another crisis like this, it's just going to be a little bit too much. But rather than postpone the problem, we'd like to be able to deal with the problem as soon as possible.
I just wanted to emphasize the issue of Section 21. Obviously, the board will not proceed with that without the approval of Parliament. It's really embarrassing. So all we're asking is that the Honourable Committee could intervene on our behalf and try and see to Treasury to make it possible to come on board.
Okay, let's maybe just briefly on this one. I mean, my understanding of what you're doing was you were saying you went, it was an implicit script.
No.
Not based, no, it was not a script I'm not a groundless saying, look, this isn't where you want to go.
Yeah.
But you're saying, the time that I've been in the community, which is since 1990, but long before that, as you did, we've not grasped the net of the issue of the right action. I think I didn't go to seven groups, so I was certainly aware of the last one, the sexual people. So when you and I came into this committee, that was pretty much the time when the first 13 years of special was reporting and reporting their department. We were very excited by the recommendations. But no one has, we've changed and fiddled, we've not transformed
yet.
And so the crisis we're sitting with is perpetuated, and in many respects it gets worse as long as we and what we're hearing. What we're hearing from you, and something I think is what we've been hearing over the last year, which is helping us as a committee, is that notwithstanding Stuart's first question, and those are questions we would keep asking about, are you getting your house in order and so on. Certainly, I don't know if other members, but I'm not hearing huge complaints. In the first years, we were hearing lots and lots of complaints about slowness of protesting and so on. But there are very active lobbies in this area. And this is a problem you hear about, you definitely hear about it very quickly. You know, I'm sure there are certain pieces of administrative problems. We're not hearing those problems now. And your own statistics and so on suggesting systems that are working better, they can be improved, and so on. But that's not the issue. And I think that's helped to clear some. The issue is the economic model.
Mm.
That's what we're saying. The sustainability of the economic model. And there is no economic model.
Yeah.
It's just a set of expectations and then a levy, which is unrelated. That's the core message of the conversation, and I must say I really agree with that. Okay, now the second one you're reminding us of is a second one. I am understanding. It's obviously what you want to implement it, or even if you want to come to us next month or whatever, after our permission to consult with us. What you're saying is, we don't want to go there, but that might be where we've got to go. Unless you talk the thing out, that's where we go. Now, we all agree. So I think we need to develop a program of action as a committee ourselves to try to continue to steer at the committee at this report and then we move on to the next meeting on our budget list that we do the annual ritual of committee. Now, I don't want to try and summarize the discussion because we haven't finished yet, but specifically on this one, on the sustainability and the modelling. I think we need to put lots of pressure on the department. Independently, hearing nothing pressure, engaging with the department, but we must do. The thing what you're saying is striking that we should call the financial services one thing. We don't normally interact with them, but we should call them in and ask them to explain their report on the road access and financial services. From what you're saying, they're not putting their hand there. They're touching the issue.
We're all touching
the issue. Yeah. All touching the issue of the road access. And so we direct our attention to this for that irritation. Lawyers, that can be very irritating. Or this or that. And those are issues that need to be considered. But that is just the heart of it. Those are all symptoms of another problem. If you're correctly saying, if we want the road access to come, and we've got to take on some other problems and use the money. So I think that's one way of trying to also engage with the treasury, because that's the levy at the moment is related to a macroeconomic model of the how much more can we place on in terms of revenues we derive on taxpayers and citizens. But it's not based on any, there's no relationship. So one of the entities to help this issue, not the only one, would be the FSC. But maybe we should just ask the critics to come in and explain to us how they, on what basis, thank you very much for the extra 5 cents, but on what basis do they want that out? Or is that just a thumb suck that they can get away with 5 cents but could get away with more? Is that it? Is that an adequate basis? So I think next, we'll have to explore this for the moment, because I think there are a number of other things we need to follow in relation to religious statements. But can we then agree, sooner rather than later, that we are present to the responsibility for the and the FSP, maybe together, so that that will show listening to what you understand, to come and explain to us how we avoid invoking in Section 21? Or is that not what I want to do? Because if that's what I want to do, then can we get our class of not invoking in Section 21, but all of it. Because we're subject. We're faking the thing. We think we've got it right after this month. We think we're, and we're not. We do a little bit of change here and there. Okay, let's come to those in a moment. But for the moment, we're talking about the funding model. Okay, so the funding model. And the things that can alleviate it, like, and your own work for having an investment that sounds like a good idea, maybe having a checking levy, a interim levy, the New Zealand case, all of those are very interesting things that can be thrown into the debate. But the key thing, the key structural thing, to have an economic model linked to this. And if you can't do that, then what do we do? So then we can't have a right action fund. I'm asking to have, but we can't have. That's
what we're doing.
So, okay. Now,
What sort of transformation? Because the I thought it's a strategic question to the board, even though it is DOT. If DOT is not fully supportive and is not presenting a picture that they support of Arena to trade Arena, it is already difficult. You know, one wants to understand whether support of RNF. It is presenting a positive picture to treasure in the US. Because, still DOT is not in full support, it's not understanding this model clearly, then RNF can dump left and right. It may not really get the lesser support from the third party.
Let's share from a place in the sense, and we're marrying to doubt that it's not supporting them, but maybe they're not. But for me, that's not the point. The point is that the way the institution, the whole method of the GOT is the patient, is as a petitioner. As a petitioner to Treasury, okay, rather than as a shaper of of the policy. And I think this applies here, and applies in a number of other areas. You said we've done many good things in South Africa, but there's one little cap we've
No, I'm afraid.
There's quite a lot of other areas where we've got lots of nice ideas, but they are all on a starvation diet here. Therefore, nothing flourishes. Too many things are like that. I mean, not that provoked here. I mean, we've heard the taxi recap project, for instance. We can debate whether it's a good thing or not. But on the current allocation, it's going to take 15 years to recap it, right? The current allocation. So it's another starvation diet. So we're doing it, but we're doing it so slowly that by the time we've recapitalized, we would have had to begin the next round of recapitalization halfway through. So you can see, we need to make some key decisions. What are we going to drive? What is the change? And then we've got to fund it. And there are other things we can't manage, but we're trying to do everything, and we've lost the change, and three quarters of those things we're not doing adequately. So we change, but we don't transform. And that's how do we do the qualitative transformation? Put things up on a sustainable basis. As opposed to one thing, and we're all petitioners. So I think we've got to the notion of a regulator coming, we haven't, as a committee, But that sounds eminently reasonable. You need a regulator dealing with language then. They then petition their regulator. They say, this is our model, this is the thing, and the regulator says, like, nurture or whatever, says, but we think your cost structure, your administration is too much, you need to print out that stuff. So that's the engagement. But it can't be an engagement with an entity which is not looking at the business, looking at the reality of itself, and just trying to put it in a very macro way. And that's the problem. So I think we need to convince people to do something. And if we can get them to really like what we're doing, then it's not going to work well.
Yeah.
So that's it. Would be an important thing that I'm seeing. Can we? Okay, but let's hear. I'm going to answer TJ real quick. But let's link it then to the amendment bill and to the other things as well, where particularly they need to support the fund, and maybe it's not done
as well. I thought this was going to be done before the fund. As one thing, the RAF wanted some cash investment. And we managed to get out of it, you know, through your team. And that's very big. And now, that was not my business. Currently, the Georgia has a danger in the petition. And then, after the vote.
He's not sure. But I think the point, and I think this is what also Melissa was saying, is that, yes, okay. But it can't be, what we did in 2006 was get the injection. And that helped. But in the absence of a model, and a sustainable model, that's gone. So it saved the rest of the thing somewhat for a while. But we're back into the same risk cycle. We've got a great answer.
If I may, I think that's exactly the key point, and I'm very interested to focus on that. Treasury is likely to take, among other reasons that they may have for their five reasons, is that not sufficient has been done to plug the hole in the RAF environment. Now, clearly we can only do so much. I think, you know, we've come to the point, including clearly also that hope is not a strategy, that we're going to need to take concrete measures, and I think we've outlined several of those. You know, and I wouldn't like the impression to be created that we think the problems only lie in other agencies' remit now to solve our issues. Please be aware that we are very acutely aware of our own failures, in this regard. You know, we've spoken about how we've increased the claim payment, we've run short of cash. And one may be tempted to use that to take, especially with the picture of our own success, but, you know, I wouldn't like to eliminate our overachieving agencies at this point. And just to show that I think that unless there is a determined political risk management process in establishing the RAF, the best financial modeling and everything we're going to do will come to nothing. No matter how much lipstick you put on this thing, it's not going to do anything. It's a view from the board.
No, I thank you for that. And I think that's exactly right. Which relates to the first question that you were on, which is that none of us, not in the committee, but take a foot off the table and then put the pressure on yourself to jack up your assets, etc. But in doing that, because I think that's where we spent a lot of our energy over the last many years, justified it, because I think it was in very poor shape. But the problem is, at the end of the day, if you're starting something, the turnaround strategy either kind of slightly better or worse, but they never kick in. That's the key to the thing that you're talking about, in my view.
I just wanted to ask you,
and I think we'll ask for him there, sorry, I know this week.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to play Morris and the Department of Transport, but because I picked the Fred Say and Max Fuller hanging for whatever, and Barbara also. So Max Fuller, Fred Say and Barbara. It might be related, might be unrelated. It's fine, doesn't matter. Let's play in your context.
I have five questions. I'm covered with the one because I want you to know, do you need the seven? And do you make any recommendations to the
Okay, they're already on. They said no. Never. And it's not because they have one. It's just because mandate wise there's no interest. But it's a good question. I
mean, my specific is awesome. With somebody who does a paralegal kind of thing. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of problems. Different countries, people come there. It's strange from people. I'm 3 years old and older. My question is then, if you just can not play in the environment of the RAF, how should a change that? Thank you.
Okay, so that's a practical good question. Consistently very good. Okay.
Yeah, most of what I have is beneficial. Most of my patients have been out. I don't want to make full of the first of this now. The question that Comrade Mashila raised about the presence of the human chief here, what influence of this?
Okay.
In that line, then my first question is. I asked this question last year, but I think I want to ask you that way. In terms of death relationship, but when you said from time to time you mentioned this
organization.
In terms of death relationship, the payment, in Australia and in New Zealand, anywhere where they have made some contributions, the payment, do they pay directly to the account of the claimant, or does it be paid to the account of the lawyer in terms of the respect of your account? And if that research has been done and completed, why are we still paying in the account of the lawyer? In line of my question again, to check about this degree of claim, the claimant, does the RAF have a strategy to check whether Open Mohal was injured in 2003? And this money has been paid. Whether to say at any stage have they ever made follow up to check with the claimant, whether the claimant has received the money and whether the money has been received in terms of the amount of cost that was to be paid to the claimant. Here's my last three questions. Is, no more, I have If you check the flight number, flight number, page number 4.
It's not the flight.
Number 4. Number 5, check. Flight number 5.
Rescue plan.
Rescue plan. Why can you stop prevalence of fraud and corruption? Why there is still fraud and corruption? And who comes with fraud? Who comes with corruption? And where are these people coming when they should be their fault? Or they can they be locked up at any point if they have been fraud?
Okay. The fourth question?
Number 6, other things like poor financial health. You know, last year we have been told that things have been turned around. Just 12 months after that, poor financial health. Why do you think?
Isn't that what we're just talking about?
No, no.
Well, there's no big issue that they're not funded.
No, no, I don't think so. Where is there no funding that has been put forward to sustain this thing? Because last year we have been told that things have been turned around. Now, again, you receive this kind of statement that says, for financial aid, clearly it has been returned.
Okay.
No one finds people around the screen.
Okay. Okay,
well, one of the things raised by the higher cost of service providers. So my first question is, what are those specific functions that you offer? And we also have to learn that the capacity is in the capacity. So what other reasons are there?
The main thing of establishing the legal how far is that? Whether it is going to be done in the financial world or it is going to be done in the legal world.
That in a way, that question summarizes, I think, all those additional questions we've had, but they're all basically in-house issues.
Yeah.
Okay? So let's flag that for the topic, because we want to reach what the planning saw is the Amendment Act, the general rapport of the Department of TURAF and the kind of support, the presence of a departmental representative on the board. There's that cluster of things related to the interface between what is the Amendment Act and where is that, and then other things in terms of the rapport between them.
I'm not sure if you can start with the relationship to the Department of Finance, playing a role and to the shareholder and the minister. I think there's clearly a very good working relationship, a very positive relationship. I think I think one thing that's very clear, we all know that sustainability is a nutshell. We all talk about the sustainability of our nation. The focus is there on both sides. We know there's different levels on an operational level, the team was able and the work that has been done. Why instead of the time? I think we're focusing on this is what we refer to as the example from here.
Yes.
But I also think on the policy is like that people have our responsibility in here. Perhaps it's also aware of our challenges. In that sense, it goes together. But I'll tell you about the platforms that there is the other side of the from the DOT and from discussing certain specific issues. But I think the main thing is the Amendment Act. There's two big challenges. The two big ones. It's a constitutional challenge. You've heard the case on the 19th of February, that's the Myers Sugar case. That's the professor, the minister, and the artist to the constitutional court. And it's all around that technicality in that one proclamation, the article 27.1. Remember, the Amendment Act is an act that was in place, it's the same governing section in that act, and then Myers Sugar took us to court. Not on the content, but on that technical or that technicality thing. But that's also a signal of future challenge.
Not everyone's understanding.
I understand what you mean by technicality,
but maybe in the interest of policy and transparency, you should say what the technicality is.
With the Amendment Act, when you proclaim it, you only proclaim certain sections in that Amendment Act. That's not the governing section. But you proclaim the wrong section number. That means instead of saying we want a maiden term activate section 1, 2, 3, 4, we should know we should need to activate say 1, 4, 6, 7, 7. We need a technical problem. A legal technical
respect.
So we rectified the same day by another proclamation. But in doing all of those things, there can be specific processes that you need to follow. You need to look and check into that process. So there was a technical, that's why I'm going to be
beyond all that.
Following this issue. There was, according to legal opinion, one word in the wording of that second proclamation that was functional. There's a legal debate around the whole issue. That's why you went right through to the Constitution. Now, I think I started by saying the challenge is then to get judgment from the Constitutional Court on the Myers Sugar case. If the judgment is negative, obviously we as a department must have to take our judgment to the right. We know exactly then, and I think one of the members said, we can then proclaim certain sections immediately, okay? So this is the governance. If you look at the act, two key areas. One is the governance section, to appoint the board, you know, all those governance related issues. And the other part is relating to tariff, to the cap, and liability. But to do that, there's another link, and the link is the regulation. You can't proclaim an act if you don't have an implementation due, which is the regulation. But also there, the way that you of put the regulations in place, we need a specific legal process to follow because a lot of minds in the so now we've learned about the attacks out of the minds here that they can be studying. Now both the RDS and the Department of Commerce both of legal advice on certain of these processes. And we know, for instance, the consultation process is very important. And we must make sure that we can consult with the regulation that you meet 100%.
Correct.
Otherwise, there will be another challenge, which will delay again the proclamation of the Act. So, the two things there is, the outcome of the Myers Sugar case, the Constitutional Court case, is all good because there's no judgment at this stage. And the second one is, we're only waiting for that to put the regulation, make sure the consultation around the regulation 100%. So whatever we do around that control system, and one of the key areas is the consultation with the medical system. I think in that sense, we also set up a platform together with different stakeholders to make 100% sure that consultation is taking place and in the right way. So you can see everything leads up the way that we tackle this issue. But what I'm saying is the Amendment Act is this. Hopefully in a week or two, the Constitutional Court will be such a judgment. The consultation on the regulation, the content of the regulation, is the answer. The method we have yet to use is what the key things that we need to consult in the right way. And that's not specifically what I'm talking about. That is in place. The approaches are there. And in a nutshell, I think I'll try to explain what is the
business. Okay, let's hold on to this. I recognize a couple of hands as well. Okay, so the point is us looking around what happens and also looking for lawyers. So I've had some contact with you saying, well, why wasn't you intending to delay the matter, but and maybe it wasn't. So why didn't we come back to Parliament? Because apparently that would force the story of my court now, is that the President couldn't rewrite his proclamation to in Parliament to do that. And we said, well, we're available, but the legal advice that you had said was that, well, I shouldn't say you couldn't do that, so, and none of them were, so we accepted that. But we really in court to continue talking, and we're very frustrated like everyone else. We just spent a lot of time on this amendment program, but now, what you're saying is the first thing that's slightly bothering me, government seems to be a problem, and it goes through. The serious injury factor, you can consult for the next 6 years, and you're not going to get an amendment to the margin, and it's going to be subject to constitutional court challenge. To challenge, court challenge, and maybe so we need to plan for that. I mean, if COVID doesn't happen, but if people write challenges and there's lots of money at stake, so we can expect that. However much it's going to cost. So consultation is important, but don't think you're going to solve the problem. Either certainly going to solve the Zimbabwe problem or this one to fight the problem. You can have as much confidence as you like. The problems are going to be there. Other than you. Okay. So then, what about the third set of issues? So not just the governance one, but the capping. Mm. Mm. Those are very critical. And those who could have mentioned into this, we haven't got the numbering of the information wrong or whatever. Those surely, once you get the hurdle, whatever petition comes in, which is the only couple of months in the book, that's a new one, though it's another. But those, need to move with information. That's what planning is on, and moving with information. And maybe we need to separate them from the serious injury matter. Because in other words, maybe the population, whatever the technical term is, needs to deal with the governance matters. And so what we're trying to do, but then got the numbers muddled up, what we're trying to do is, in my view, tactically strategically do the smart thing to do, which is we know something is going to come under challenge. That's the difference in my view. Let's not compromise the whole thing and the implementation of the whole thing by making it all or nothing. Let's keep the same thing we've seen after, let's keep the negotiation going. I mean, in any case, it wasn't just a conversation, it was also about the health of the money that you need very quickly. Can we not, therefore, proclaim the governance issues and the capping issues, and then maybe in a separate moment, or whatever, how lawyers would deal with it, get the right from that. Then, because we must also move on to the second series of new things, and then see how that, I don't know whether you need to separate them or whether a challenge to the serious injury thing won't compromise the other side of things, but let's be very clear about that so that we don't make the same mistake again, that the whole thing is held up because of a challenge around that. There are a couple that have been published and I think it's
true. Yeah, thank you. When the
I think there was a problem.
Maybe we should have done what you're saying then. We're hoping that there will be a constitutional court within a week or two. That's the hope over there. If it looks like it's taking longer, then I think we need to come back to you. But I think the key question now is, and obviously it would depend on the nature of the judgment, but presumably the judgment can go in one of two fundamental directions. What we're saying to the government is, be ready for scenario A and scenario B. We are ready. We're going to come back from this in order to expedite the matter. Because the work is done. It's not as though, on the regulation front, the work maybe hasn't been done, or we've moved that or whatever. But the thing we want to fast track. So here from you may well be a complicated matter. So I share your urgency, but let's not get a legal opinion now at this point about what you can do, because we see that's going to be academic events in a week or two, once there's a constitutional judge. If there's not, then we can go to that. Maybe we need to blame ourselves for not being sufficiently activist on that front earlier, when it's time to make it. So what we're saying is, we're sure that's the case, but please be ready for either one or two options, scenarios, and please get up hard, quickly, and we will do our best. We will be in recess within a couple of weeks, this is really critical, this is really key, so we will see what we can do. Come up with a response. So if you have a sense of urgency about it, within the next couple of months, we need to Okay. Then, okay, so that's the specific issue. Then, there's a more general issue around the recall and so on. But yeah, I was trying to say that you're going to be doing that.
Maybe just on the regulation side. The challenge around the regulation, what do we portray? So the regulations are, yes,
but you can see that part of anything else? No, 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 no. Okay. Okay. Shall we move along then to the in-house issue?
So,
more ranging through with the offensive eighth person, which you call sixth. And the public saying a number of us, and Max also who's here, because we've got to go.
Right. Thank you, Chip. Maybe let me deal with some of those questions, and perhaps I think the member who's just left. We actually don't have a formal process to meet with National Treasury, as we have said, so it is a problem, and so we can't do that. How long should a claim take? Because I think that was the second question that he asked. You know, I guess the easy answer to the question is related to the system that we administer. For as long as we are administering a toll-based system of compensation, it actually adds weeks and months to the claims that we're dealing with. By that I mean that, you know, a toll-based system of compensation forces us as a fund to go and deal with a wrongdoer and prove that he wasn't at fault in the accident before we pay them. Now, to prove fault, it requires all this evidence and all those sort of stuff, the tire marks, and in reality, to become as very little value. You know, and again, that therein lies the problem. What we actually should be having is a system where somebody's provided with cover, and we don't actually have to ask whether you are at fault or not, and then we pay, and all the other, I guess, societal issues like, you know, do you pay for somebody who's drunk and, you know, when he's involved in an accident or an illegal immigrant and those sort of things. Those you can cover as excluded in legislation. In fact, even our small little neighbors, when I say small, with respect to them, but Botswana in the legislation, they have, I mean, the legislation, there's a lot more thought that's gone in it than there is in our one. I mean, for example, they will do and say if somebody was an illegal immigrant, they will only pay for emergency medical treatment. They will never get loss of income and that sort of thing. But you know, here in the system that we administer, we're paying for some of those things. So there is no thought that's gone into our law. When I say this, it's not to be too critical. But I'm saying you can learn a lot more from other funds. I mean, they have things like reciprocity. What they're saying is that Swiss National would never be able to claim in Botswana if a Botswana wasn't entitled to claim $2 billion from their fund. Now, with us, is that Swiss National is claiming $2.2 billion from us, and he actually cannot even claim from his own country a tiny fraction of the amount he's claiming from us, and we are developing economy. So a lot more needs to go into those. But coming back to answering the question with how long it will take, we wanted to put in systems in place, and the best way is to answer it by an analogy. We want the system where somebody, when they get worked into a hospital, or for those people who have medical aid, if you go and swap your medical aid at a clinic and you get your prescription, depending on the nature of the injury or the nature of the treatment that you're getting, a claim can be paid as quickly as 24 hours, or with medical aid if, say, the treatment is a major treatment, like a heart bypass, then you get pre-authorization. So the length of time it should take to pay a claim depends on the nature of the claim, how complicated it is, the size and all those sort of stuff. But it should be anything from, 24 hours to, 30 days after the treatment is provided. And maybe getting back to the questions that I think Honorable Offensive was asking. We do look at best practices throughout the world. But trust me, you go to New Zealand and Australia, they pay the claimant directly. They don't deal with middle. And I think it's this fault-based system of compensation that is causing us to deal with middlemen. But I think with us it's also a historic practice. You've got this issue, that's called power of attorney. So whenever somebody gets involved in an accident, an attorney quickly gets to this court claimant and they force them to sign a power of attorney. And what the power of attorney says to them is that they will represent them, they will actually become stand in their place in everything relating to the claim. Submitting documents and claiming from the funds and all those sort of stuff, including getting paid. And they refuse to give us bank accounts. And when we said we're going to introduce this direct payment system, not only do they fight, they refuse to give us claimants bank accounts so that we can pay directly into the claimant's bank account. They say, no, they signed a power of attorney. So obviously we try to get legal opinion to determine whether it stops us from giving directly to the claimant. And the opinion says, in reality, that they are just an agent and a principal. We can still deal with the principal directly. And in fact, it also deals with a question that was asked, what are the activities that we're doing? The strategies that we're employing to start making the claimants aware of the payments that we're making. We're busy actually developing those and finalizing them. One of them is we want to actually go to the press, like some of the insurance companies, when they settle a claim, they go and put an advert in the press and say, we have paid X amount. And that's some of the activities that we want to introduce, because those attorneys, they refuse to give us bank accounts. And we're also going to have to use the media to get access to some of those bank accounts and stuff like that. So we're one of the few countries that pay money to third parties. Do we have a strategy to check? Those are the strategies that we're busy trying to implement. We do have complaints with people saying, they haven't been paid, and then we follow. But we haven't been as proactive, and that's one of the things that we want to say, this is a list of claims we've settled, and this is the amount. Because the claimants have got no idea what is taking to their attorney's bank account. And sometimes they take 50,000 and they give them a pittance, little 10 rand or 1,000 rand, and say, this is all we got. But not only that, they also sit with the money for years and years and years and interest, and say, the RAF hasn't done anything. And we would have paid. And so it's that control that we've lost that we want to gain them. And the question of fraud, and why are we still dealing with fraud? And unfortunately, and this is a presentation I think we did, I did put to this committee last year, so let me put this slide up, that we suffer two types of fraud. Okay? The opportunistic fraud we can deal with. So when we go and implement test systems, new claim systems, and that sort of thing, you put in there systems and controls that makes it difficult for somebody to perpetrate fraud. Because there's a fraud where somebody says, listen, this is a weak system. It's an opportunity for me to steal money. Like somebody who leaves, say, the wallet on the desk, it's just an opportunity. If you have a system where somebody doesn't leave the wallet on the desk, there's no opportunity. And that's a fraud that we are dealing with as we implement new systems. But unfortunately, we have a systemic fraud in the area, in the sense that a lot of the fraud arises out of the legislation we are administering. So people who are not genuinely injured, they still claim. Because they're saying, my neck is sore, or tiny little bump had this in accident. although we're not even involved in the doctors who are over-servicing. So there's a lot of fraud that is perpetrated that is based on the system that we administrate. And it encourages this. And this one we can only deal with if we change the system. We take out the need for a lot of people to get involved in as middlemen. You start dealing with some of the fraud. And you take out the ability for people to claim for whiplash and all that sort of stuff. And in certain jurisdictions, for instance, you are required, in Australia you are required to report an accident within 14 days of the accident happening. And it's got nothing to do with prescription. So your claim can still take 3 years to prescribe, but if you haven't reported it within so many days, you cannot claim. With us, you can actually claim 21 years after the accident. And then say to the fund, come and prove to me that you are not at fault, and and because you have, if you're a minor, you have up to that period of time until you reach majority for this. And people take advantage of those sort of things. So there's a question relating to fraud. But we are tightening this up. And we do have syndicates who are dealing with us, but we take them because we are closing this loop very quickly. The RAF has actually been operating paper-based systems and is now getting more and more computerized. And maybe at some point in time in the future, we'll show you some of the systems that we have that we implemented. Because there will not be a movement of paper. Paper will be captured once. It's called workflow solution. And it's going to do away with some of those things. Now, the question of poor financial health, this is not a new issue. When we put these key issues facing the RAF, I think I was trying to reflect on what we shared with this committee 2 years ago. And what we were saying to the committee is, these are the problems that we've highlighted. But we recognize that we cannot deal with them on our own. So, if our legislation were allowing us to go and change the model, we would have changed it. Unfortunately, we need Parliament to change the model because the model is also ingrained in legislation. So it took this committee to propose amendment act to start putting checks on the benefits. So to change the nature of the benefits, RAF management cannot just simply go and change the benefits. We have to change them through the legal process. And all we are saying is, We do need help in areas where we can't do it ourselves. We do need help, and I think that's the gist of the discussion. Now the issue of high cost of service providers, what functions do we outsource and insource, and that sort of thing. If you look at the amount of money that we spend as the area, the bulk of the cash we spend in legal fees. In fact, our own employee cost, as I said, around 400 million, 435, we're projecting for the end of this year. But we're using panel attorneys. I guess we could call it an outsourced service, which when we look at an in-house law firm, maybe one area where we are insourcing. But infrastructure-wise, IT and all those sort of things, we actually are busy finalizing plans to look at the best way to deal with some of those things. So there's an IT platform. We need specialists to make sure that the server is up and running all the time. It's not our core business. So some of those things we're looking at outsourcing. But in terms of render amount, the real big money currently is really on legal fees and stuff like that. Now, I guess the similar question, what has changed? It sounded like we had a good message last year, and why does these things look different? I guess the problem though is we probably are a product of our success. We're doing too well, and then we start running out of problems, out of money, and then we can't deliver suddenly. And now we have to say to people, sit and do nothing, which really negates all the achievements that you want them to do. So you want to be as efficient as you can, but the more efficient you get, and if you haven't closed some of the loops, you see, we haven't dealt with all the things that we've had in the ground in terms of funding the basic amendments and the model and everything else. So if it sounds like doom and gloom, that's because we are actually getting more efficient and then we start running into problems, which suddenly takes us all the way there. Because suddenly if you're saying, sir, we can't pay you, that pattern is going to start issuing risks and again, that's a real problem. We haven't looked at the area holistically yet. I think one element is moving faster than the other, and that's where they get it. I think that deals with all the questions I had on my
mind. So we've got moving more closer then. Let's try to summarize what we've got. I think first of all, we were agreeing that we're going to adjust our program a little bit. Maybe even as soon as, because we've got a budget example, we need to see the rail safety regulator, we need to see the government corporation and the sunrise come on the table. Maybe we want to know all these messages as our part, but maybe we'll feel some time. We're looking at rail safety regulator, user corporation, and AT&S. AT&S I'm not worried about. So maybe we should aim for Tuesday the 18th and see if we can't get Treasury and SST and ourselves. I don't know if we can pull it off, but let's aim for that. So jump the program to do that. So that's the first thing. Hopefully by then also we might be in a position where we've heard from the competition court and we can then develop jointly. I mean, it needs to be driven by the Department of Transport, but obviously we need to be partners in that process. We can look at what needs to be done with the parliamentary one. So the main thing is we've got to, in the next month or two, begin the implementation of the Amendment Act. Even if it's not implemented all aspects of it, producer of security injury comes under another court process. At least we must be hampered by that in order to, and that's going to happen in the next. Should it happen? Then the process that we're trying to take forward with the Treasury and Financial Services Board and other matters that have come, and particularly then in engagement with the Department, are matters that will eventually have to be legislated. In all probability, like having a regulator, that's where the project sector, which would be a critical mechanism for sorting out these things. Maybe there's a different mechanism, but some institutionalized mechanism that is different from the first article 5.6. Obviously runs the area and doesn't run too much. Now in practice, I mean let's see where it takes us. But it probably means that beyond the life of this policy. Okay. But if we can move quicker than that, that's good. We need to implement the industry rather than just create the momentum. We're coming to an end now.
Yeah.
Let's see the next year, but we'll hardly be in politics. So, yeah, we're fighting an election. Complacency. So, we're hard to find it. So, really, we've got two little time to get these things through. But at the very least, let's make sure that we've got an irreversible momentum. But maybe we can be more fruitful. Then there's other things. I mean, the whole tax system, the key thing, no benefits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not cost. It's not going to cost that much. But no cost. No benefits. Otherwise, yeah, Section 21 is the no benefits. No benefits or no cost. And then this is the one or the other. But this hasn't got a drive. You can't drive with no problem. You can't drive it from Holland. I mean, you can put pressure procedure. So let's see these things, what we're planning to do. There's two things we're planning to do. Well, the third thing is to keep pressure on yourself. and the people asking the questions, but some are saying, and Ben said, and I'm sure some are coming for rain. Okay, the scene is in the front. That's why you guys also come to the front. So we'll do that, okay. But the transformative issues are getting the amendment act going, and then laying the base, not that you're not too comfortable with that, there's a whole lot of other things that have to be done. On model, potential of a regulator of a car, the no fault system. That's at the heart of the festival index. And seeing the whole thing as part of the comprehensive social security net. And then relocating it into a different department. All of those things are slightly longer term, but they're being, we haven't had progress.
Yeah.
That's what haven't gone and we've not gone. It's still okay. Let's create momentum, but let's try and use this year to create serious momentum and therefore see these other different pieces that we do, chemistry, electricity, and transforming momentum. And therefore also not be satisfied with just getting this serious injury thing out of the way and so on. We're doing serious legislation to move towards the
thank you, sir.
So that's how we should try and think of from our, you've got to be thinking in the end of your year, meaning we should have a sort of self-life now. Anything else from members while we're there? Okay.
I just think that, you know, in the progress in the period, not immediately when you fall. There is a like this one of the music. When you fall then there's somebody in RES to give you exactly where is your train and how far is your train. I think this is a very good program. I don't know whether it is still running now. But it's a very good program. And I wish that as part of the program, it will assist the community to understand exactly.
Okay.
Because most people don't exist in the community.
Okay.
I think that those are some of the new changes that we're putting in place with assistance and processes.
Okay, what would be very useful for us? Okay, because we all, the people that are here in the transport committee, I guess, and they accept this as well there, and I'm sure we would have it, and they've quite a lot. Maybe you could just ask, in a sense, maybe the financial services board is here, and you should say the same with country. Could you maybe just give us a little one pager on contact?
Yes.
Okay. We've got people who have been in the past and so on. But so that we can consider that we can't answer the problem that people have come to us with in constituencies and so on. But some kind of contact point, reference point and so on, that kind of thing, very, very useful. And perhaps what we'll do in particular is within our respective caucuses as well. DA and so on. Bearing in mind your problem, we understand that you want to advertise yourself, but at this stage, at this precarious point, you don't want to advertise yourself. It's more with people that have lost trains and then where they are, not sure what training is on. That would be very useful for us.
Can I thank them? Can I thank them?
Okay, apparently announcement. Okay. On SABC tonight at 9:30, 21:30, the taxi recap project is going to be a discussion project. On SABC 2. Okay. Alright,
so
that's an announcement. Jimmy?
You've got seven. Those are the responses to the question I've asked.
I did ask what is the strategic role of a member of a DOC in RAF board? How is the board of RAF utilizing that particular member? And how is the member also servicing the board? That's what I asked, and probably I was sitting when the
okay.
If I was not sleeping, then that means no.
I think we all found the question maybe a little bit uncomfortably personal. Which is why we were hoping you were sleeping. But you're right. And it's okay for you. And remember from the department, it's here.
But because of crisis, sometimes more on it.
So there's damage control meetings and then regular meetings. And then but you would attend, you would not be a member of a subcommittee. If you're of a committee, you're involved.
No.
I mean, this is a we're just trying to and this is critical to the whole thing that we've been trying to do in terms of governance, is to improve the link, and that's useful to get. So would you get good departmental support in terms of support as you go to a meeting, would you be effectively mandated?
No.
I don't mean in some high sense, but would you go with
I think
Not that we want to get to see to have some firm unbiblical mandate, because we've got an instruction from the Bible. Sometimes that's unbiblical, but there are other occasions where you don't want to undermine the collectivity of the board, but at the same time, we would want to see the board benefiting from the influence and the sort of bird's eye view that we see that the Bible sometimes have.
But I think looking at it from outside, what the department does need is to actually be given sufficient capacity to make things happen. I mean, you ask for legislation and all those sort of stuff, and I think that's what they need, just resources. I think they need to be really fully resourced.
In terms of
really making things happen.
Interface we should be having with yourself, really, as Transport, is how do we bring it down? What are you finding out about capital and accident and so on? And what are we doing about from the Transport side to lower them and so on? So there's a discussion between the departments. But it's the wrong line of policy. It's the wrong department to engineer, which is a capital recommendation. So how about the question general? So we're going to have that problem, but obviously until we change it, we must make the best of what we can do. Should we leave it there for the moment? Thanks if you would like that, and thank you for the question. It's not working perfectly either for yourself or for them. It's hard to see how it might be very difficult. We also think, and we know the DG thinks that the department is actually this, that international best practice suggests that you have a two departments rather than one department. Never mind where that's in some. But, I mean, from logistics to maritime to aviation, almost, public transit will be an important issue. I mean, that's where we come closest to. And then and some of them are huge, including yourself.
And
one
of
them. So that's another, not the burden of the shovel, but that's another thing we need to really need to think about.
I think it's
the origin for the technical, the origin of 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 the technical, the Okay, can we step down then? We'll see each other on Tuesday again. And then we're busy with the cross-border.
Jefferson, I don't know whether I'm able to stay. On behalf of the delegation, I just want to thank you, Chair, and the honorable members. In the manner you should deal with our issues. And we appreciate very much the way that we started, you know, how we should deal with the issues, the outstanding issues. We very much like to be part of the other, to be in the meeting with the other stakeholders. Because we really see, if we are not arrested, this situation, this organization is like getting to a creative organization it used to be. And thank you very much, really, Leonard.
Did I want it or did I want it?
I'm going to go to the next one. And our family stuff at the show. Thank you.